So today I'm speaking with Adrian Higgy. Unfortunately, James Hammond, no matter how he tried and how hard he tried, he couldn't make it today. So it's between Adrian and me. Adrian and I go back a long, long time. He now works for WSP, but he has done all the rounds from working for the EPA as a regulator. He then joined AMPOL as a non-regulator. He then became a consultant, so he has done the entire circle. He's a very seasoned environmental engineer. He has a very scientifically minded approach to things. He has plenty of papers and publications to his name. But most importantly, Adrian is always willing to share his knowledge. So whenever I get stuck with things, that I have this pool of people who I can fall back to and say, hey, how do we solve this and this? And some of them, I hope, are listening now and they will say, yeah, I'm in that pool. And yes, he calls me all the time. But that's part of how things work in our industry, especially when you're working for a smaller company, like I have all my life. So all the younger engineers out there now, one of the most important things that you can do in your career is you build a pool of people that you can call on, because you can never know everything. So Adrian is certainly in my pool of people. And I was listening to his talk the other day in the chlorinated hydrocarbon symposium down in Adelaide, and I was fascinated with what he had to say. So here's my talk with Adrian. I hope you enjoy it, and next week James will be back.
You know, we met a long time ago. You were working for AMPOL. You had come out of the EPA and then you started working for AMPOL. Is that right?
Yes.
I fondly remember the meeting we had with the guy from
My goodness. Yes, that's right.
He walked into that room with his offsiders and it looked like the Godfather had walked in. It was unbelievable. And his claim was that an AMPOL service station next door had contaminated some of his land.
That's right.
I guess to a degree he had a point. But I do remember I was a noob. It was 1995. Is that possible?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Fond memories when he walked in and you said, look, we are here to look at that. And, you know, here's the contamination. And he immediately interrupted you and says, you know, and I assume for all the cleanup, you're going to be paying for this. That was his first sentence. I'm like, man, how to start off a meeting. This is...
Yeah. Yes, well, I guess he was a... So that's all he thinks about. Are you paying for this?
Yeah, he was. I remember that meeting. And I must say, both you and Charlie Barber, you showed me how these business meetings work. You guys, like, there was no intimidation going on there. It's like, yeah, you want to play this game? After all, I'm AMPOL. And yes. That's right. It's like you want to be playing this game. No, it was good. So you were EPA, then you were AMPOL, and after AMPOL, you went to, what did you do then?
Consulting. That's when I became a consultant after AMPOL.
Okay, and then you ended up with WSP, and you are a big hotshot there now.
Yes, maybe.
What? We now and then cross paths, usually at some, either it's a seminar or a conference or whatever.
Yes.
And the most recent one where we met was the chlorinated hydrocarbon conference in Adelaide, where you spoke about your method of delineating subsurface plumes via measuring above surface vapor flux. Is that correct? Is that put it nicely?
Well, that's very, very well, put well.
So define flux for me. When we're talking flux, what are you talking about?
Well, flux just means a flow of matter, a movement of matter. In this case, it's vapor flux, so it's mass moving as vapors. In the ground, there's a lot of air, and so there's a lot of vapor diffusion happening in the ground.
For people not entirely familiar with subsurface conditions, when you say there's a lot of vapor in soil, that to a non-environmental engineer already sounds suspicious. It's like, hang on, there's soil. What the hell, where is the vapor in there? Where is vapor in soil?
Yes, well, vapor is between the solid particles of the soil because the solid particles are individual particles, and so there's airspace there.
Yeah. I always imagine it like you go to the beach with your children and you have a little bucket and you fill it full of sand, and that bucket is full. Until you go and you pour in that full bucket, you can easily pour another cup of water in there. Yes. Although the bucket was full of soil, that water disappears in the pores between the sand grains. And that's pretty much where soil vapor is in the subsurface. So you may have a contamination source that sits in the subsurface, be it floating on the groundwater or be it an underground tank or whatever it is. It forms vapors, and these vapors move in those pores that are between the soil particles. Is that a good analogy?
Yes, that's as good as you need to get.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess one important principle to recognize is that molecules in the vapor phase move randomly. They just don't have any pattern of movement. Every individual molecule moves in a random fashion. And if you've got a contaminated source under the ground, some of it will evaporate. Those molecules of vapor will move randomly away. A lot of them just come up to the surface. And so we're measuring the molecules that reach the surface.
Soil vapor, is that a big deal?
Yes, of course it's a big deal if there's some toxic chemicals in it. We only worry about soil vapors when those vapors pass through the ground, up through the floor of the building and into the building airspace.
So usually when we talk contamination, when I talk to my friends about contamination, I mean, the easiest thing to understand is that if you have contaminated soil and you somehow get that into a receptor's system, into a human, how do you get it into a human? Usually it's via ingestion, so that you get exposed to it and you somehow get, you inhale the dust or you touch a substance and it goes through dermal absorption, or most likely you actually start eating part of it through whatever pathway. So that's one way of dealing with it. So that's, you know, how the heavy metals are a classic example of that. If you have subsurface contamination from, say, a service station, it's such a cliche with the contaminated service station, but you know, there is contaminants under there sometimes, and these are very volatile. So you don't actually have to get even in contact with this contamination in the subsurface, because this kind of contamination manages to move through the soil and find its way potentially to people above the ground. That's where the soil vapor issue comes in. And I think that's what people need to understand. It's another pathway of people getting exposed to certain types of contaminants.
Yes, and yes.
So hydrocarbons, when we talk hydrocarbons, it's generally petroleum hydrocarbons. So, you know, the petrol and the diesel and the oils that we are talking about. Now suddenly you threw in a term called chlorinated hydrocarbons. What are these babies?
Yes, well, they're just hydrocarbons. They're designed to be very effective cleaners, degreasers, but they've got chlorine on them. Chlorinated compounds made from hydrocarbons that have chlorine on them cause human health impacts. They are toxic to humans. But the other major feature of them is that they are so stable. They resist breaking down. They last a long time in the environment. Typically, we can have trichloroethylene or TCE in the ground without a lot of degradation for more than 50 years, probably more than 100 years.
That's unheard of in normal, I was going to say not normal, in the more run-of-the-mill hydrocarbons that we find in petrol or in diesel or in oils. They break down rather readily. They tend to disappear or get bioremediated by themselves if you leave them alone in the right conditions. So the chlorinated ones don't do that. Aren't the chlorinated ones also have a very nasty side effect, not side effect, but property? They're heavier than water.
Yes, they are heavier than water. That doesn't really cause us a major problem compared to the light hydrocarbons, because they've got to be pretty much dissolved before we see them at the surface. We see the vapors at the surface, and the vapors have come from largely the dissolve phase on the soil particles, vaporizing off the, you know, this dissolved liquid phase. So the heavy product, if there's enough of it, sinks to the bottom of the aquifer, and we're not seeing the vapors from that. We're seeing the vapors from the dissolved phase that is caused by the pure phase that has sunk to the bottom. But it doesn't matter that they're heavier, really.
So how do you, in a traditional way, how do you delineate some hydrocarbon plume?
Yes, well, the conventional wisdom is that if there's a hydrocarbon plume, you will examine it by putting in groundwater wells and analyzing the dissolve phase, analyzing the contaminants in the water. And of course, if they're there, you'll find them. So that's not an issue. It's only that it is rather expensive to put in wells and analyze the water. And it's not a silly thing to do, but you can only put in so many wells before you run out of money.
Well, it's so easily said, oh, you put a couple of wells in and you sample the water. This is an expensive exercise. Drilling, you need a drill rig, you have people out there, you have land locators out there, you have traffic stops, you have access restrictions because you have buildings, you have council requirements, you have NBN lines running. Let's just put a couple of wells in. Sounds really easy, but it isn't. It's a major drama from an organizational point of view. It's also a drama from a practical point of view. We have a big drill rig that needs to drill. You have to core through all sorts of concrete surfaces and so on. So let's just put a couple of wells in is easily said, but that's how we delineate, hey, we have hydrocarbon impacts in the water or in this plume, and we need to investigate that. The only way how to do that was, or yeah, still is to a large extent, by drilling down. Or when you say, look, let's have a look, right? There's groundwater. Nobody's using groundwater in that area, so let's assume that the groundwater is impacted, but it's moving under an area where we really need to know, are there any explosive or carcinogenic vapors rising from this contamination? You could go and measure vapors that accumulate in the sub-slab area or in the near-surface area, which is also rather expensive, although you don't need massive drill rigs. But as soon as you interfere with the surface and as soon as you put things down there, it's a bit of a drama, right?
That's right. The conventional way of investigating any hydrocarbon plume is to maybe even first measure it in the soil, but we often skip that because soil measurements of chlorinated solvents aren't very useful at all. You can't really use the data for much. So you put in groundwater monitoring wells. The next step, when you get heavy hits of groundwater concentrations, you then think, well, we better have a look at the concentrations in the soil profile near the surface. And that's a sensible thing to do too. But still, it doesn't tell you whether there's a risk to human health or not. It tells you that there is a potential risk to human health. So the only way you really know whether there's a risk to human health, you have to measure the mass flux coming off the ground. And from that, you can quite easily predict what the concentrations of that contaminant in a building would be if you build a building over that land. Depends on the flooring, of course, but you get a very good indication of what the worst case concentrations in the building would be.
So we have an underground plume of some contaminant. It may not even move under a building, but it may move under a site that is yet to be developed, or a site that has something on it, but will at a later stage. Now it's a warehouse, and at a later stage we will have some apartment blocks or whatever on that site. What you said before was that measuring the groundwater concentrations is more or less a useless measurement we only know what's in the groundwater, but we don't know whether this contaminant in the groundwater will make its way into my future apartment building that's not even there yet. So that's one of the big problems we have, right? So not only is the investigation of those plumes extremely expensive, but also the information that you get out of it is rather limited. I wouldn't say useless, but it is very limited because you need to take those concentrations and then say, well, and if I have these concentrations and we assume these and these parameters like soil permeability, vapor pressures, temperatures, and so on, maybe we can estimate how much of this plume will actually make its way into my future building. It's a rather complicated and error-prone process.
Yes, that's right. You're talking about modeling. Now, put it this way. If you got within a factor of 10 of the real answer, you'd be very, very lucky, and you'd think, wow, we really did a good job with that modeling. That's a factor of 10. More often than not, using the model, you would be within a factor of 100. Now, that's not really good enough for a sensible answer as to whether or not there's a risk or not. So you need a better way, and measuring fluxes that are coming out of the ground is really a great deal more accurate or reliable.
Well, that's because you are bypassing a lot of unpleasant things. Everything that's unpleasant about it, about delineating hydrocarbon plumes, which we spoke about before, and you're bypassing the uncertainties, right? You say a factor of 10 as a best case scenario. A factor of 10 is a catastrophe. How much is this car going to cost that you're about to buy? Well, is it going to be $10,000 or $100,000? That factor of 10 rolls off your tongue so easily, but it makes things useless. You, on the other hand, your method of dealing with all these problems is completely different. You say, hey, why don't we measure what is actually coming up to the surface where we have receptors like humans?
Yes.
So you say, I don't care. Well, not really, but you say, ultimately, what are the contaminant concentrations in the subsurface is less important to know than what the concentrations above the ground are where the humans may get exposed to these.
Yes, that's fairly obvious, yes. But I might point out that the argument a hardcore modeler would use to discount the value of flux measurements or indoor air measurements is this, that the modeling is taking long-term average conditions, which is relevant to risk assessment, whereas measurement of what you've actually got in a building or measurement of what's coming up through the ground is a short-term measurement, and it's liable to vary sometimes quite a bit. So that is the argument, and there is some validity in that argument, but the other principle is that with environmental measurement, you normally, if there's an issue, if there's a significant problem to investigate, you don't just measure once. We want several times. Sometimes you have groundwater monitoring programs that run every 3 months or every twice a year. You know, you do it.
Yeah.
You should have the practice of repeating your measurements.
So, Adrian, how do you measure how much of minute amounts of concentrations are actually reaching the surface? How do you do that?
Yes. So there's we say by vapor flux chamber. So you put something on the ground. No, it doesn't help much. But what I'm getting at is that the concept of measuring vapor fluxes from surfaces is nothing new. It's been around in various forms of science for a long time. And even in our own contaminated land industry, there have been flux chambers since the late 1980s. It operated on a complex principle. They called it the dynamic flux chamber. And and they used it for contaminated land risk assessment all through the 1990s until the expertise in its use faded away because people just moved on, I suppose. So we developed this passive flux chamber, which is so simple. We were just totally amazed why no one had invented it before.
this is exactly why we are sitting here, because I'm sitting in this conference and you are one of the keynote speakers. I can read you my notes. I'm an old fashioned. I still take notes when I listen to someone, right? So I suddenly stopped writing notes because I had to listen to you. And the last words I wrote on my notes, I'm not kidding you, are just a capital wow. In my eyes, what you presented there is phenomenally groundbreaking. It is so simple. Basically, you take a cooking bowl, a bowl where you mix your salad in it, right? You turn it upside down and you put a passive vapor probe in there. And that tube is a passive one. It doesn't suck any air. It just sits there and gets exposed to any contaminant that gets trapped under this bowl.
That's right. That's exactly right.
These hydrocarbon plumes or chlorinated hydrocarbon plumes cause soil vapor. That soil vapor manages to find its way into the environment above ground. What you do is you put a little lid on it and you measure how much of these contaminants get caught under your lid.
So it's how much is absorbed in a unit of time in a unit area of surface. So we express it as mass per square meter per hour.
Layman terms, how many grams of petrol per square meter per week come out of this surface? That's the kind of question you're after.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And the cool thing about this is, in case someone has missed it, you can put this chamber or this bowl, you can put that down anywhere. You don't need to drill. You can be right above an NBN line. You can be inside a building. You can be inside a school. You can be inside a factory building, or you can be on a footpath. Yes. You don't have to drill. You get your data without any mucking around, because these molecules that you're after, they find their way to the surface and you catch them. Now, doesn't it matter whether there is a concrete surface or whether we are in open parkland? Does that matter?
The surface or the profile that you've got will affect the flux rate. So if you had a bare ground and you're measuring the flux out of the bare surface, you're going to have a bigger flux than if you measured on a concrete slab that was placed on over that same contaminated area. But that's what we're measuring. We're measuring what the flux rate is through to the atmosphere.
Without any guessing. See, this is this is the beauty. And I only became aware of it in your talk because I thought, once you have a concrete slab, that's the end of any flux of contaminants. Yeah, I couldn't be more wrong. How does the flux through concrete even happen?
Well, the concrete has a pore space. You know, it's not absolutely dense. You know, it's got airspace in there. It's quite porous, and it's porous to water too. If you wet concrete, water soaks into it. And conversely, the air that's underneath the slab also soaks into it upwards. Well, when I say soak, I mean the air particles diffuse through the concrete. It's porous. And you can imagine how tiny a molecule is. It sees the pore space in concrete as massive caverns. It doesn't stop the vapors from moving through concrete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a concrete seal is not a seal, not to a molecule that is that tiny.
That's right, yes.
In summary, you have developed a method where you can very, very accurately determine the extent of a subsurface plume, a plume being an area of contamination. This week, I wrote two proposals where I need to know, are there chlorinated hydrocarbons under my slab? I don't want to even drill, because after having heard your talk, thinking there's such a much smarter way of going about this.
Yes.
This is a method of determining not only the extent of the underground impacted area, the subsurface area that's impacted, but also does that impact, without any guesswork, make it into my area of concern, into my building, into the area where I want to build, or into wherever I'm worried about, without any intrusive equals expensive work. You put an upside down bowl on there and you put your measuring probe inside, and you leave it there. Do you have any problems with people messing with those probes?
Just occasionally.
Okay.
Yes, occasionally. But you have people messing with anything occasionally. It's not a reason why I shouldn't use them.
Now, here's the last challenge that I see here. Our industry has a lot of guidelines, and they all end in the subsurface. And then you are more or less stuck with modeling, where you say, if I have this much in the subsurface, it would probably end up being this much in my target area or in my area of concern.
Yes.
How do you overcome that?
That's not an issue, because the flux is used to work out what concentration would result in a building. So we calculate from the flux rate what the indoor air concentration will be. Mm-hmm. So we don't need a guideline for flux. We just use the acceptable indoor air concentration. As much as the regulatory guidance is very conservative and not really appreciative of the value of flux, I might just quote this to you, because this is in our own NEPM, and it is in a subsection titled Flux Chamber Methods. This is what it says. The technique enables direct measurements of vapor flux from the surface of the ground or building foundation, thus providing a direct estimate of the parameters of interest, rather than calculating it from subsurface vapor distributions. Flux methods effectively integrate all subsurface processes. For example, phase partitioning, biodegradation, preferential pathways, advective and diffusive transport, often close to the point of potential exposure. So if you were new to the NEPM and you read that, you'd think, well, why on earth don't we use flux chambers all the time?
That's why I wrote wow into my notes of the conference. I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, why isn't everybody jumping up? Because this is such an absolutely revolutionary way of dealing with the problems that we sometimes face in our industry. Well done. How long have you been working on it?
It started off slowly, but by 2009, we realized that, hey, we've got to get this new method, polished up and published.
Good luck with it. I am sure you and I, we will be flux measuring in the future together. This is awesome.
Yes, it's certainly available to all. It's published in the scientific literature. It's available for anyone to use.
Thanks, Adrian, for coming on. Thanks for chatting with me. Your time is precious, I know.
Well, thanks, Gunnar. Good to chat.
Thank you. Bye.